Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Ancient History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, and today I'm speaking with Michael Leese, author of the book Making Money in Ancient Athens. Michael, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's really nice to be on here.
Well, it's nice to have you on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. I'm an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of New Hampshire. And I started off as a classicist. I took Greek and Latin for many years, wanted to do ancient history. And eventually went on to grad school to work on ancient Greek history and started getting focused in economic history pretty early in that process and came across this topic while I was doing my graduate work. And I've been working on it ever since.
It's a fascinating topic, and it's one that I had all sorts of questions about because I was fascinated by how it is you can recover economic history, especially given you wouldn't think that. I mean, nowadays we think of economic history in terms of statistics. We think of it in terms of all sorts of analytical measurements that we don't necessarily, you know, associate with ancient history or the information available about it. How is it that you're able to do economic history about the ancient Greece?
That's a really good question. There have been a lot of people who have sort of claimed that you could not do economic history exactly for the reason that we don't have statistics or any kind of quantitative data that can be reliably reconstructed and applied to the economy as a whole, like GDP or gross income or anything like that. So there have been a number of different approaches to try to do economic history. And at one point, I was thinking of doing something quantitative myself, because we do have some data from the ancient world. But then pretty quickly, I moved on to doing a qualitative study. The main issue that I came across that kept recurring and was emphasized over and over again about the real differences between the ancient and the modern economy was actually a qualitative issue. It was, did the people in the ancient world think and act the same way that we do, especially when it comes to economic matters? So the evidence that was in the source material for ancient Greece, and especially for Athens, was actually sufficient to be able to address this issue.
It's a fascinating topic, and I found it very interesting to read about it, because it's a question that, it's one of those questions that doesn't pop to mind. It's one of those things that I think about when I read ancient history. It's just, I assume it. And yet you demonstrate that it is a not only a worthwhile question, but it's one that there's a lot of interesting information about. And it really opens an aspect of Greek history that, you know, we don't often think about.
The claims that you come across in a lot of the older scholarship, and a lot of this goes back to the 19th century, starting with Marx and Weber, are really eye-catching. And I kept coming back to these things, just seeing how they would argue the differences in mental processes, the differences in attitudes towards economic activity, the different value systems that discourage them from behaving like modern capitalists. These are very strong, provocative statements, and they shaped the field for decades and even generations. And every time I would come and away from that scholarship, that theory, and then look at the ancient Greek evidence, I didn't see any of the things that they were talking about. So I knew that there was a very sort of a large amount of data that could be applied to this issue to sort of prove that ancient people were not as different as has often been argued, and is still argued today by a number of people in a number of different fields. And when you really get into the material and you see how they were making the decisions they were making, what kind of approach they took to different economic issues and problems, they become much more like the modern mind than what we see in a lot of scholarship.
That was one of the things that struck me as I was reading was the similarities. And it was something I thought you did very nicely when you brought in a lot of modern authors about contemporary economics and how a lot of their ideas and axioms were at play in the ancient world as well.
Absolutely. When you're reading, because I had to read modern economic theory, anthropological theory, economic history, studied a wide variety of pre-modern societies, like not just ancient Greece, but also Rome, ancient Mesopotamia, the Italian city-states during the Renaissance period, and early modern Europe. And when you're comparing all these things, and then you're looking at how modern economists discuss individual behavior, economic decision-making, the sort of mentality of the people, whether or not it's approximate to what modern capitalists have, you start to see just, well, first of all, what a complex issue this is, how many different problems are intersecting within, you know, pretty much every part of the scholarship. But also when you're looking at this, you start to see things in the ancient evidence that you didn't see before you started reading these modern economists and about later economic systems. So I took this perspective, reading modern economics, studying these other ancient and pre-modern historical societies down to the Industrial Revolution. And even after, a lot of the material I cite is talking about economic behavior in the 20th and 21st century. When you're looking at all of these things, and then you look back at the ancient evidence, it becomes pretty clear that the claims that ancient Greeks and, you know, I'll include Romans and Mesopotamians and many other ancient peoples in this too, that they did not think and act the way modern economically rational actors act, it completely is undermined by the evidence. There's so much evidence to support the idea that they were just as rational and irrational as we are. And I think bringing in that full picture was kind of decisive in being able to prove the point in the end, as I think I do.
I do want to get into the case studies that you examine in your book, but I want to begin by looking at your explanation or your analysis of the ancient writings about profit and wealth maximization, because you write about these distinguished authors, you know, Xenophon, Plato, and Aristotle, and we associate them with philosophy, with science, with history. We don't think of them as economic writers. And while they certainly were not writing in the vein of, say, Adam Smith or Karl Marx, you point out that they do have a lot to, they do reveal a lot about what the ancient Greeks thought about in terms of not just profit, but wealth maximization.
Yes, there's a ton in these philosophers, and the sort of the nitty gritty of my individual case studies, which I'm sure we'll get to, is about, you know, the way ancient Greeks managed their own personal estates, and we can get into the details of that. But there's so much evidence about how Greeks overall or Athenians overall behaved in the economy that these philosophers, Xenophon, Plato, and Aristotle, describe in great detail. And when you are looking at these theories that really are trying to explain the rise of the modern economy, this is kind of the focus of much economic history. And the main theory keeps coming in different forms, and it's sort of articulated differently in different fields, different contexts, different theorists, that ancient people were not economically rational, and that they did not try to maximize their profits. They did not try to continuously reinvest their profits into a further productive enterprise. When you read Xenophon, Plato, and Aristotle, you actually get a much different picture than this. You see Greeks responding to fluctuations in market prices that are running according to supply and demand, just like in the modern economy. And the way they're responding to these market price changes is by trying to reinvest in more profitable enterprise. You also see these discussions about the mental processes that are guiding ancient Greeks when they're making their economic decisions. So Plato and Aristotle have very detailed, what I call theories of the mind. They see the mind in ancient Greek, and the Greek for that is psyche, so the word that gives us psychology. But the mind, or the soul, which psyche also means in ancient Greek, but they didn't have the same kind of theory about the separation between the mind and the soul that we have, which is another fascinating topic. But when I was getting into these theories of the mind, I started to see some of the best evidence that had never been discussed in any of these studies of the ancient economy. What we see is a rational part of the mind, which engages in rational decision-making and in a very similar process that's described in modern theory of rational choice and economic rationality in particular. We also see that there is an emotional part of the psyche, which directs people to behave in certain ways and sort of makes them more impulsive or more likely to try to pursue pleasure or wealth or other things like this. So incorporating emotions into the discussion of economic decision making was really important. I wanted to make sure I did that. But these theories of the mind that Plato and Aristotle have, when you're looking at how they're seeing people behave, they see that they are trying to maximize their pleasure. They're trying to maximize their return. And it depends on the person. But often one of the main goals is wealth for the things that are people trying to maximize. And Plato even calls one of the parts of the mind, the money-loving portion of the mind, or the money-making portion of the mind. And this was the kind of thing that really jumped out at me and in my mind really needed to be incorporated into the discussion of ancient economic history. Because if Plato and Aristotle are saying things that are so fundamental that the Greeks have an entire portion of their mind that could be labeled the money-loving or the money-making portion of the mind. This is absolutely significant for how we interpret the behavior of the people in that society.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we could now turn to those case studies and start by talking about what you spend the most space on in your book, which is discussing the family estates. And I'm not going to try to pronounce the Greek name for them that you use, because my ancient Greek is non-existent. But I was wondering if you could talk a bit about these estates, perhaps a bit as to, you know, how we can, you know, retrieve this information that we have about them, but also how it was that they sought to make money on these estates, and how this is how this informs this understanding that you've derived about, you know, how the Greeks made money.
Right. Yeah. So the whole critique that had been leveled against people who tried to argue for economic rationality in the pre-modern world before was that we don't see individuals over the course of their lifetime trying to maximize profit or wealth with clearly described processes of economic decision making, with a wide range of options at their disposal. Often people just assumed that agriculture and land were the only available investments. So some of the arguments for economic rationality in the past were shot down quite incisively by other members of the field for very specific reasons. And the reasons were that what we needed to see to prove economic rationality was the decision-making process, both over the course of a person's career, over the course of their lifetime, and also within individual transactions. Now, the estate management cases that I look at in chapter two and chapter three, or sorry, chapter three and chapter four. Chapter two and chapter three. Yes, sorry, the chapter numbers changed from one time to the next. These are all estates whose contents are described at length in ancient Greek lawsuit, private lawsuit cases. And these private lawsuit cases are an absolute treasure trove for economic behavior of many other aspects of ancient life as well. But what we see are individual estates whose contents are described at length and whose owners' motivations, their actions, the decisions that they make, both within individual transactions and over the course of their career, can be reproduced in pretty reasonable confidence. And what we see is I divide the estates between those that are diversified across a number of different types of production or economic profitable activity, and then those that are specialized in one type of profitable activity. And the reason for that is because diversification has often been pointed to as being a sort of traditional, more risk-averse activity that's characteristic more of a what has often been called in the scholarship a quote unquote traditional peasant mindset. And this is the kind of thing that's been dominant in the field for decades, and it's changed, you know, a lot in the last, you know, 20, 25 years or so, but these sorts of arguments recur in different forms. So what I wanted to show here was that the diversification that we see in ancient Greek estate management actually could follow a profit and long-term wealth-oriented strategy, and not one that was just to try to, you know, buffer the risks of rain and you know, temperature shifts and locusts, you know, descending on fields and things like that. So looking at these diversified estates, what I saw was in almost every case where the owners tried to acquire new properties, there was always a profitable sort of outcome for that, or a profit-oriented motivation for that. And this is different from the risk-averse or risk-minimizing motivation that's usually been argued for the ancient world. And you can see the sort of long-term orientation towards profit in a number of ways. One is when people acquire more risky, more high-risk acquisitions to increase their profitability alongside more stable investments that they already have that are already generating a steady income. So a lot of the new properties that are acquired or new economic activities that people enter are characterized by higher risk and higher profit rather than lower risk and lower return. Now, the other thing that we see is long-term wealth maximization that is made possible through avoiding taxes. Tax evasion is rampant throughout all of history. And we talk about it today. There's nothing new about it at all. And what we see in the evidence for ancient Greece, it's not just Athens. We get it from Syracuse. We get it from a number of other city-states as well. But the desire to avoid taxation, when we see this happening on an individual estate, the long-term result of this is really remarkable growth and kind of unnatural. I'm not going to say exponential growth necessarily, but really otherwise impossible long-term growth. So we have a couple of examples. The probably the longest case that I look at is the father of the famous orator Demosthenes, who is the sort of most prolific or at least best preserved rhetorical rhetorician speaker from ancient Athens. his father managed an estate that was able to avoid taxation, it seems, throughout the course of his entire career. And it seems that it was only when Demosthenes himself inherited the estate, and he actually had some guardians who were embezzling from it after his father died and before Demosthenes was able to claim it. But it was only after the estate was made public in a series of actions, including the inheritance case that Demosthenes himself brought against his guardians, that only after all that publicity had drawn attention to the estate that finally it started to be subject to taxation, and Demosthenes himself had to pay taxes as a result of this. But his father was able to avoid it his entire career and had an estate that was about five times the level that we would expect for someone to have to pay taxes in ancient Athens. Now, one more is in chapter two, my first example, this estate owner named Arizelas. And Arizelas is explicitly said to have acquired profitable mining interests to increase the profitability and the return to his estate. But then he sold his most visibly productive assets when it became clear that he was going to be subject to paying taxes to the state. And once he said that he feared liturgies, which is the form of taxation in ancient Athens, once it's said that he became fearful of those, he sold all of his visible assets that were producing profit and reinvested that wealth into a hidden form. So hiding wealth from the state allowed for really remarkable long-term wealth maximization. And that's one of the patterns that I'm arguing is supporting this economically rational, profit-oriented, maximizing approach to estate management.
Yeah, that gets to something that occurred to me as I was reading the book is the degree to which you are reinforcing the adage about how man is an economic animal, because there's so much behavior that we see that we can associate with them. And I'm thinking when you talk about the question of specialization, you begin not with Demosthenes or another ancient actor. You begin with Andrew Carnegie, and you have his very famous contradictory, comment that instead of diversifying, you need to specialize, and how shocking that was to common sense in the 19th century. And yet you point out that that was something that they understood back then. And you explain how, that was something that was actually rewarded in terms of how the people who did specialize oftentimes built these very spectacular fortunes and enjoyed enormous prosperity.
Absolutely. The keep your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. That quote by Carnegie really resonated with what I was seeing in the ancient material. So some of the most spectacular fortunes that we see were focused in the silver mining industry in Athens, manufacturing industry, especially wartime manufacturing during the Peloponnesian War, for a very large large market with endless demand. Also for bankers and moneylenders, we see the long-term specialization in these highly profitable, very risky, but with really unparalleled returns. This kind of specialization created absolutely fantastic fortunes, some of which modern scholars don't even believe because they're really so amazing. And even some ancient people mention these fortunes, and they say there's no way that they could have made that much. But the number of estates that we have, the level of wealth from people who specialize in silver mining, production, banking, and money lending, really consistently across the board shows that specializing in these activities long term was one of the main ways that people would try to maximize their profits, try to increase the size of their estates, try to maximize their wealth over the course of their long lifetime, just like a modern capitalist. And what we see is a continuous reinvestment of profit into continuously productive enterprise. And the sort of implications of this are really important, and we can save some of that for the end if you want. But the careers that we have preserved for bankers, silver miners, and money lenders show us that the people who did were able to succeed in these fields, there was a lot of competition or a lot of people who entered and exit, a lot of bank failures because so many people went into the field and so overextended themselves in risky banking or money lending practices that they went under. We hear about banks going under all the time. And then bankers going into hiding so that they don't have to repay their creditors and and things like this. But the overall sort of implication of all this is that the mentality that we usually say, or that many people say, was responsible for the modern industrial capitalist system was already there in ancient Greece. And it's just that no one has proven this for the pre-modern world yet. A really important set of estates, people specializing long term and reinvesting their profits in that productive enterprise that was yielding them so much money, that really points to this kind of modern economic rationality that was pretty widespread among their population.
As you explained, though, not everyone sought to make their money honestly. And this gets to one of my favorite parts of your book, which is your description of Zenothemis? And his case with regarding maritime trade. I thought it was fascinating, not just because it's an example of what we might think of as a classic case of fraud in a literal sense, but it's also how it exposes the differences that existed, how we're not talking about a world where you have a concept of international law. You have a lot of legality in terms that governing these transactions. That legality stops at the city-state's border. And a lot of these merchants and bankers oftentimes use that gray area that existed or that advantage of imperfect information to not just make money, but sometimes try to do so fraudulently.
Absolutely. And I think for the arguments I'm trying to make here and the sort of similarities that I'm trying to draw with the modern world, modern economic activity, the sort of strategies people have used, these fraudulent characters, the ones who took advantage of the sort of gray area of international enforcement in between city states, especially on the open seas, really shows this kind of opportunistic, profit hungry, profit maximizing activity. And when you're looking at this sort of, area in which traders and moneylenders are able to operate without, sort of fear of a city coming and enforcing its law, it really was kind of the Wild West in a lot of ways. And what we see are examples of people who will make a deal in one port, and then they'll come and they'll make a deal on the same goods at the next port, and then they'll make a deal on the same goods at the next port and just pile up the money and then plan just to escape. And so what we have here...
That reminded me of when I was reading, I just couldn't help think of The Producers, the Mel Brooks play in the movie, because it sounded like that. We're going to get enough investors here going, and then we're going to... I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil the story. Go on, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. So yeah, it's exactly this kind of producers-like scheme where you can just... Because there's no, there are no cell phones, there's no long... distance communication. There's no ID cards. There's no anything like that. Really, someone could operate with anonymity. They could move faster than the information about whatever reputation they had acquired could move. So they could stay ahead of any warnings if someone did know that they were up to anything sketchy. And they could make enough money in the short term that they could then go off and retire with it. And in a lot of ways, when we're thinking about ancient trade, we sort of have this modern model in our mind where there's, just sort of at least a well-developed information system and surveillance and police and this sort of thing. But really, when we're talking about ancient Greek trade, especially outside of a polis, because they were able to police within the bounds of their own city state. And this is why their local markets were all filled with trust and encouraged trade and were actually pretty well controlled. But once you got out into the open sea in between states, it was more like what we would consider sort of the black market. So people are operating more in ways that they do in international arms smuggling or international drug trade or something like that. So that kind of activity being so rampant in the ancient economy, or at least being enough attested in the material that we have multiple speeches describing it, and laws that the ancient Greeks had to pass to try to fight it, that it was believable to their audience. And we can see it as believable as well, because we see sort of modern drug dealers acting the same way, or other people engaged in certain kind of illegal economic activity. So that kind of activity being present in the ancient Greek evidence was, I think, really another decisive sort of indication that the way people are behaving, the way they're manipulating information, the way they're trying to restrict access to profitable opportunities to themselves and the people closest to them, really shows just how much, how familiar their actions are to someone in the modern world. And we hear about stuff like this in the news all the time. And when you read it in an ancient Greek court case, it's really, you know, it's almost like the Judge Judy, sometimes I say, of the ancient world. But these are real people, and the things they're doing are familiar to us today. And it's really uncanny almost just how similar we are to the ancient Greeks.
And of course, the fact that they were willing to engage in such fraudulent activities, which, you know, even in the more lawless gray areas that existed, were nonetheless, risky, demonstrates the just how powerful of motivation the concept of profit maximization was. That they could have gotten a profit, for example, on a shipment of grain, but you know, you have these people that are willing to engage in fraud because they can make 3, 4, or 5 times more by engaging in this fraud, and how that there was no constraint, or it was a thought that very much occurred in this idea. Let's go ahead and make as much money as possible. That's a goal that these people aspired to, and were in those instances willing to do so illegally.
Right, and it's in these maritime trade deals that we really see the motivation, the mentality that's going into these specific transactions. We see them trying to maximize the number of transactions they can make during a single trip. So they overload ships to the point that they sink. We see them trying to maximize the amount of money they can get from a single trade voyage. They even try to maximize the number of deals they can make from a single loan. So usually a loan's made for one deal, but then if they get to the next port and they find that there's a better deal they can make with that money, they'll do that instead, and then come back and try to make a second or third deal before they have to go back and pay the original loan. So they're trying to maximize the number of deals and profits that they can flip during the course of a single loan. And these loan contracts have time limits built into them as well. So they could actually calculate whether it was more profitable to break the due date in the loan contract, the original loan contract, so that they could make multiple separate, what would be essentially illegal side deals. Because in the end, the amount of profit they could get from multiple deals using one original loan could be more than just satisfying the terms of that original loan. And like you were saying, this kind of really almost reckless, you know, but you can see their thirst for money and how just how closely calculating and how sort of, you know, eager to make as much profit as possible in these specific court cases. So for me, it was the maritime trading chapter that really sort of proved that the kind of mentality, the motivation for profit, and really the kind of, you know, no holds barred, anything goes, you know, pursuit of wealth, you know, on the open seas and sort of beyond the reach of any sort of legal enforcement. Like you were saying, it really shows how the profit oriented, the profit maximizing, the wealth maximizing mentality manifested itself within a specific transaction. So within these individual economic deals, I think we could see a lot of the best evidence for this mentality, which really is, it's not just characteristic of modern capitalists, but people operating on the fringes and taking advantage of loopholes in the system and trying to maximize, you know, in ways that might be, if not illegal, certainly on the sort of touching on, you know, what might be ethical or moral in the modern world.
What was the benefit of wealth maximization for them? Was it simply a matter of acquiring the stability and comfort that came with wealth, or were there added advantages to gaining as much profit as possible?
Wealth provided so many benefits in ancient Greece, and this is one of the things that people have argued sort of against profit and wealth maximization. Often they said people sought honor, they sought public standing, and that wealth was sort of seen as, or at least wealth maximizing activity was seen as kind of like a sketchy, dirty, sordid thing. And this idea comes from the sort of statements that we get from ancient philosophers like Aristotle and Plato, which I distinguish in this book between prescriptive and descriptive. So these prescriptive statements we see in Aristotle and Plato come from philosophers who just want people to get along. They want their city-states to be thriving. They don't want citizens to be taking advantage of each other economically, because that creates a wider wealth gap between rich and poor. It disenfranchises the middle class, and it leads to a concentration of wealth among who they thought were the most sketchy and untrustworthy and wicked people. There's a thing in ancient Greece that wealth is blind, because the goddess Wealth, because if she could see, she would give money to the good people, but instead it's all the wicked people who have it. but when you're thinking of an aristocratic system, and here I bring in the work of Torstein Veblen, and the sort of highest members of the leisure class, they engage in different kind of economic behavior than people who are trying to rise up through the economic and social ladder. So the people at the very top don't want to sort of visibly be engaging in profit-oriented activities on the market, because this makes it look like they don't have as much money as they actually do. So for them, appearing like they just live lives of leisure, it's essential to cementing and demonstrating and proving their status at the very top of the social and economic elite. But everyone who's trying to rise up through the ladder is engaging in this kind of market-oriented, profit-maximizing activity, because they're not yet at that point where they can just sort of sit back and demonstrate their wealth through their leisure. But the other thing is that the people who are at the top, they're not just sitting on their wealth, right, like a dragon sitting on a pile of money. They're still investing it in agriculture and cash crops, banking, often money lending, and the kind of money that they're able to bring in comes from their ability to monopolize the land. So one thing that we see is that the aristocracies of the ancient world are kind of the end of a long-term process of monopolization that comes out of competition in the open market for land. And when you think of it in these terms, it looks like these large estate landowners who have large numbers of slaves and livestock, in the competition in which they're beating out middle and lower class people for the competition for land, they're starting to look a lot more like modern corporations beating out smaller mom and pop shops. And so once you get to that sort of level where you've acquired a large amount of land for yourself, you can let the land produce. You can bring in your profits. You are really in control over one of the most important factors of production, which is the land itself, which is also the capital. So the sort of the dynamics of what we see happening up at the top and the most wealthy people are much more complicated than what people have argued in the past. But as they demonstrate, people get honor, they get standing, they get all these great benefits. There's no insurance in the ancient world, so money brings you safety. It helps feed your family. It helps buffer you against risk that comes from, you know, warfare or disease or bad weather. So all the things that, and actually the way the ancient Greeks described the lives of the gods and of the golden age of humanity back in the old sort of mythical days when human beings were, you know, sort of closer to the gods, the way they described the gods living and the way that they described the people of the golden age living are the same way that they describe the benefits that aristocrats and the super wealthy have. So if you're an ancient Greek and you can maximize your profit and your wealth and you keep your enterprises going, making money, you can also share in a lot of the benefits that people in the golden age of humanity or even the gods themselves had. So these kinds of like freedom from worry, freedom from anxiety, freedom from the risk of losing everything all at once in one bad harvest. There were so many benefits that came with wealth, and a lot of this hasn't been discussed in the scholarship before. So I was glad I was able to bring all that into the book as well.
We appreciate the time you've taken to speak with us. But before we go, could we ask what you're working on now?
Sure. Yeah, this is two projects that are coming out of this original one. So the first is a case study that started to get too big for the book. And so I started writing an article about it. It's this famous Athenian general, Nicias, who also was one of the most brutal enslavers of the ancient world. He had 1,000 enslaved people working in his silver mine. And he's famous from Thucydides, from the disastrous Sicilian expedition that almost brought Athens to defeat in the Peloponnesian War, although they were able to keep fighting on for almost another 10 years, which is really fascinating in itself. But his sort of approach to economic activity is really interesting because he has a whole range of evidence that describes his religious beliefs and his spiritual practices. And he's often said to be very superstitious. But when we look at his money-making activity and also his activities as a general, he seems to be coldly calculating and as rational as you could possibly be. So using him as sort of a model, I'm exploring in what might be a short book, sort of discussion of how the ancient Greek religious mentality affected the way that their economy performed. Because old arguments in the past have claimed that because Greeks were dedicating so much wealth to the gods, that this took it out of circulation and that it sort of froze economic activity the way like a depression where there's no circulation of money would freeze activity. So that the ancient economy was permanently in a depressive crunch for money because it was all sitting at sanctuaries. But this is not the case. And when you're looking at his economic mentality, his religious beliefs, and then how much wealth was actually dedicated at ancient Greek sanctuaries, you get a totally different picture. And it looks like the economy is functioning quite well. So this is something I'm going to be looking at. But my major project is following from this book. And I'm saying that it's a wide range of institutional factors that can explain the difference between the ancient and the modern economy. Whereas people have argued for differences in rationality or psychological differences or totally different mentality, I'm saying that the fact that the ancient Greeks did not have corporations and the fact that they did not have things like international land market, that these factors are actually more important for explaining why the ancient Greek economy didn't evolve past the point that it did. And what we're really talking about here is long-term theories of development and sophistication. And a lot of this is very teleological, But what I'm really trying to do here is to show that you can have rational behavior, the way I argue in this first book, but that without these sort of institutions of the modern economy and the technology, let's be honest here, the Industrial Revolution machinery was so important for that. But because we don't have the institutions of the modern economy, especially corporate personhood and corporate immortality for private business wealth, the institutions of the ancient Greek world channeled capital and money flow, money accumulation in very different ways. And a lot of the arguments in the past have been that this is all a sign of irrationality. But what I'm arguing is that it's actually what people are doing are a rational response to the institutional realities that they did have. And what we're going to see, I hope, in the end with this book, is kind of a reassessment of a lot of the sort of long-term trends in economic history in the ancient Greek world, and how these can all be described by looking at this very different institutional structure and the choices people made with their profits and their capital investments.
Well, those both sound like fascinating projects. I wish you the best of luck with them.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and really the goal in the end is to bring the ancient economy, pre-modern economy, more into dialogue with economic history of later periods, because people who study later periods and other societies depend on us, the experts who work on the pre-modern world, to tell them what happened, because they just don't have the time for the training to look at the primary sources themselves. But what I'm hoping is that this is going to be a step towards sort of bringing not just ancient Greece, but also ancient India, Mesopotamia, Africa, the pre-modern, pre-Columbian Americas, and pre-modern Europe into sort of a longer discussion where we can see how what did happen in the modern industrial capitalist system was not the kind of transformation that has often been argued, but it's actually a very slow, gradual process which suddenly accelerates in the 19th century. But really what this is all pointing to is to try to bring periods that are often studied separately into closer dialogue so that we can have a better idea of what it really was that created the modern economy. And the more I look, the more I see it's the result of there's technological innovation and institutional innovation, but also the same kind of rapacious attacking imperialism, stealing of wealth and funneling it back to the colonizing imperialist homeland that we see throughout all of world history. So I think if we can sort of reframe a lot of modern economic, what we would call progress, or a lot of people in the field have called progress before, in those terms, I think we can get at a more accurate view of long-term economic history overall and where the ancient world, generally speaking, sort of fits into all of that.
Well, that's a very ambitious goal and a very worthy one, too. I look forward to seeing how it develops.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it'll be probably the work of a lot of different people, but I'm glad, glad to be able to contribute just a little bit to that.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. You too.